And you're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live. My name is Norman Otis Richmond. Today is May Day, May 1st, 2004. And joining me on the line all the way from Brisbane, Australia, is Gerald Horn. How are you doing?
Oh, fine. And yourself?
Not too bad. I guess it's 14 hours difference. It's I guess your internal system must be kind of in turmoil now.
Yeah, in a sense, but one of the things that's keeping me on an even keel is that for the last few days I've been in Canberra, Australia, the National Library of Australia, and Canadians should be happy to know that their tax dollars are at work there, because when you enter the lobby, there is a major exhibition featuring the work of Oscar Peterson, and it was delivered to the National Library of Australia by the National Library of Canada, and it features biographical information, you know, posters, pictures, and then the capstone of it is a Yamaha grand piano that has been programmed by a computer to play a lot of Mr. Peterson's solo tunes, and so you can, like, stand in front of the piano and watch the keys and marvel at the manual dexterity that he obviously possesses.
So, you know, Oscar Peterson is very computer literate. He might have had something to do with programming that himself. Hello.
Sorry, two people were talking. I couldn't hear.
Oh, I said that Oscar Peterson is very computer literate. So I think that he probably may have programmed that himself.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a marvelous exhibition. I assume that it was up in Canada before it came all the way out here.
Well, he has a CD out. That's probably part of that CD that he has.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. But it was very useful to see Canadian tax dollars at work. I should also say, speaking of Canada, that I also had an opportunity to see the appearance of the White House of Mr. Paul Martin and Mr. Bush just a day or two ago, when they had met about the Canadian participation in the Afghan War, on questions of mad cow disease, etc. And it was quite remarkable to see them together. Is Mr. Martin a native French speaker? Certainly his French was better than Mr. Bush's English.
I would think that as long as Mr. Martin has been in Canada, he could. Yeah, he's good with the language. He is being under Chrétien and Trudeau. He had to learn some French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was. As I said, I mean, I guess it's not really saying that much, saying that his French is better than Mr. Bush's English, but it was still noticeable.
Well, I understand that meeting was, I heard the reports on that meeting, and they are basically, the papers here and all the commentators are very disappointed because apparently Martin didn't get anything but a lot of talk, a lot of platitudes, and Martin is saying that he's going to deal with the United States in a more sophisticated way, and people are saying that that is like... backhand slap at Chrétien and basically Chrétien. But they talked about hockey, baseball, Haiti, BSE, and the whole the soft lumber situation. But I don't think softwood lumber. But I don't think Mr. Martin got anything, because they talked about the differences that Canada had on the question of marijuana, the question of abortion, gay rights, and Mr. Martin is backpedaling on the marijuana issue, on the abortion issue, and on the gay rights issue, same-sex marriage issue. And I guess, I don't know if you've heard this, but Joe Clark has come out in support of Paul Martin as opposed to Stephen Harper.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. That's intriguing. Well, one of the things that's obviously conspicuous being out here in Australia is that this country, in a sense, is trapped by history. That is to say that, I think it's fair to say, and I don't mean this in a glib or flippant way, that it was not a very good idea to establish an outpost of white supremacy in the Asia-Pacific region, as was done by London in 1788. you know, of course, that there was a so-called White Australia policy up until the 1960s, where immigration was quite limited from Africa, from Asia, etc. Although I should mention parenthetically that it's quite interesting, if you look at Australian history, one of the first rebellions against British rule out here in the 1850s, there was a leading role played by some people. It's hard to say whether they were U.S. Negroes or West Indians, because what happens is that because of immigration questions, you often found U.S. Negroes out here who were passing, so to speak, or masquerading as West Indians, as Jamaicans, for example. But despite that episode in history, certainly there was a very consistent white supremacist policy. And now, of course, there has been a change, but despite the change, at least officially, in terms of those white supremacist policies, you still find a lot of resentment of Australia by its neighbors. There is a rather cool and distant relationship between Australia's closest neighbor, which is Indonesia, the largest predominantly Islamic nation in the world, and Australia. You might recall the Bali bombing of October 2002.
That was quite significant.
Scores of Australians were killed as a result of a bombing allegedly set by so-called Islamic fundamentalists. And as a result, Australia finds that it has to sort of tail after the United States because of national security reasons. And so therefore, John Howard's government in Canberra has been a faithful lapdog of U.S. policy in Iraq and elsewhere. Of course, there are Australian boots on the ground in Iraq. And so this, of course, continues to engender resentment in this part of the world. The fact that Mr. Howard has talked about being a deputy sheriff of Washington and has boasted about its ability to shape the internal politics of Asian countries. And so, quite frankly, it's rather unsustainable, the present foreign policy course of Australia. But as Australia sees it, or at least as the conservative government of Australia sees it, it basically has no alternative. But we see, of course, that just as it sort of tailed after London before, say, 1945, and that led to disaster when Japan launched the Pacific War, now Australia faces a similar dilemma in 2004.
Now, I'm speaking to Professor Gerald Horn, author of a great book called Race War. Pardon me. Now, what is how does it feel being in Brisbane in terms of Australia as an African? I know you talked about you felt pretty comfortable in New Delhi and places like that. You had a few hassles in I think Cape Town, you said.
Right.
But how do you feel as a black man in Australia?
It's mixed, quite frankly. Because Australia is a faithful lapdog of U.S. imperialism, I find that because of my accent, which I've been told is a U.S. accent, that I get less hassles as a result of that. But, of course, I have to open my mouth first. It reminds me of being in London, for example, where you have the same sort of dilemma. Brisbane, of course, is in Queensland, in northern Australia, north of Sydney, north of Melbourne, the two major population centers. And Queensland was noted for having a form of slavery, of black slavery, in fact. And that is to say that the indigenous people from South Sea Islands were imported here, as they say, in the 1870s in particular, going forward to work as slaves on sugar plantations. And so as a result, you'll see a larger dark-skinned population in Brisbane, Australia, than you'll see in Canberra, for example. Although there's an interesting phenomenon about Australia, which is that it has one of the highest skin cancer rates in the world. It's very hot and sunny, not only in Brisbane, but in this country generally. And you have a lot of pale-skinned people who don't wear hats, who don't use sunscreen, and so skin cancer is cutting a prodigious swath throughout this country, and of course, I'm sure some cynics would see that as some sort of environmental revenge. Might say that this is what happens when you engage in genocide against the indigenous and expropriation of their land.
Being an act of Allah or an act of God punishing the Europeans, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure some would say that. But as I said, it's quite remarkable to walk the streets here and to see all these sunburned people. And I mean, it's without wearing hats. It reminds me of being in the United States, in fact, in Tucson, Arizona, which has a similar sort of temperature and climate. You also have a high skin cancer rate. And as I said, I wonder why these people don't wear long sleeves and put on hats.
I guess they don't.
Like they're trying to defy reality.
I guess they don't want to be portrayed as B-boys. You know, they don't want to walk around with the hats backwards, I guess.
I guess, but as I said, skin cancer is emerging triumphant in Brisbane, Australia.
Okay, I'm speaking to Professor Gerald Horn, author of a book, From the Barrel of a Gun and Race War. Now, I wanted to ask you, today is May Day. May 1st is May Day. How is May Day being celebrated where you are? And it's my understanding that there are three countries in the world that don't celebrate May Day: Canada, the United States, and South Africa. I don't know if that's true. I know under the apartheid regime, I know in the United States they call it all kind of different things, and we don't get a day off for May Day. There's a lot of activities that are taking place in this particular country and in this city. But is that an accurate statement that May Day is not celebrated in the United States, where it originated from? And South Africa?
Well, I think there's been a change in South Africa. It's interesting, the model, and certainly, of course, you know, the anti-worker, anti-progressive United States, you know, looks at May Day the way the devil looks at holy water. I mean, it's seen as anathema personified. But Australia has an interesting history in that regard. Just like the model in the United States was to import dark-skinned people and turn them into slaves, you did have, as I said, a form of slavery here in Queensland, but generally the model was to eliminate dark-skinned people, that is to say, the Aboriginal population. And one way to summarize Australia beginning in 1788 was basically through the motto, you know, workers unite for a white Australia. And that sort of mixture of sort of workers unite, i.e., quote, progressive, unquote, and for a white Australia, that is to say, reactionary, unquote, means that May Day is celebrated in this country. As a matter of fact, Monday will be a holiday. It's going to be marked on this coming Monday, and everything will be shut down. And if you look at visitors' accounts, travelers' accounts, for example, when Mark Twain visited here in the 1890s, he marveled at the kind of social democratic policies and sort of worker, pro-worker policies that existed. It's also interesting, too, that in New Zealand, for example, was one of the first countries where women had the right to vote, which is also an extension of that same kind of ethos. So, just to summarize, there's an interesting mixture of progressivism and reactionary politics in the South Pacific, or in the White Pacific, as some might call it. But I would be remiss if I did not mention that one of the reasons why May Day will be remembered in 2004 going forward is because of EU enlargement. I mean, it's quite remarkable that the European Union has taken on 10 new countries. It's a very significant development. European Union continues its march forward, which, of course, I'm sure means or makes for a certain kind of ambivalence amongst progressives, because on the one hand, the more powerful the European Union gets, the more the European Union can challenge U.S. imperialism. But at the same time, of course, it's remarkable that countries that were once ruled by socialist and communist parties now have basically been integrated into this France-German-led behemoth known as the European Union.
Can you talk about those 10 countries?
Well,
Poland?
Slovakia, Slovenia, Cyprus, which of course is a story in and of itself because the Brussels feels somewhat traduced in the sense that the Greek Cypriots voted just a few days ago overwhelmingly against re-merging, so to speak, with their Turkish Cypriot neighbors. But what's remarkable, of course, is the sort of angst that this enlargement is inducing, particularly amongst the EU working class, because there is this angst about immigration in the European Union, and this is being played upon, manipulated by the right-wing press in Western Europe in particular. For example, in Britain, there have been headlines the past few days warning about a so-called inundation of Eastern and Central European labor into Great Britain. It's been somewhat racist headlines, too, because they're warning in particular about an inundation of Gypsy or Roma labor. And there are fears even on the left about this, because just like in the United States, the fact that the working class is, quote, racially, unquote, divided, which has undermined social solidarity and undermined the necessity and possibility of social welfare legislation, there is a fear now that with migration and immigration, with EU enlargement, that something similar will be taking place within the EU. So in various circles, this EU enlargement is being viewed as a mixed blessing.
I'm speaking to Professor Gerald Horn. Now, we talk about that left. It's interesting. You mentioned Israel a few minutes ago, and Israel was supposedly, I guess, a social democratic state, but they excluded people of color. It was a social democratic state or a socialist state for those European people, Jewish people of European ancestry. And I guess we had a similar situation in Australia where you had a mixture of racism and socialism, which almost sounds like Nazism, I guess.
Well, you know, the historians oftentimes use the term herinvoke democracy, that is to say, democracy for our folks only,
right,
so to speak. And I think that certainly captures and personifies Australian history since 1788. And obviously, it captures to a certain extent North American history, and I'm afraid it also captures Canadian history to a certain degree. Because we know Canada also has faced and has endured racist policies, particularly towards peoples of African and Asian descent.
Now, I wanted to move to the Haiti. I was speaking to your good friend Ilombe Brath earlier, and it's my understanding that La Tatou does not want reparations. He has told the basically said that, you know, reparations is a lot of it's foolishness. We don't want the money back from France. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm sure you heard the stories and seen the email traffic suggesting that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why Mr. Aristide was dislodged and overthrown was because of his pressing a huge reparations claim against France. I should also mention that Mr. La Tatou of Haiti is not alone. Perhaps there's something in the water in certain Francophone nations, because President Wade of Senegal has also been in the forefront of those also disclaiming the need for reparations.
Right.
But I think basically that they're swimming against the tide, that the moment for reparations has indeed arrived, and it's not going away. And I think that these, quote, Western, unquote, nations, as they like to style themselves, even Australia, they call it a Western nation, even though it's east of Europe. But, you know, anyway, that's another story. Even in Australia, of course, the Aboriginal population is pressing significant and sustained claims for reparations, and have met with some success, particularly with regard to reclaiming their land, which has been systematically expropriated by these Europeans over the past 200-plus years.
Speaking to Professor Gerald Horn, how are your books doing in Australia? Are your books in the libraries, in the bookstores? Have you seen any of work that you've done in anywhere in Australia or New Zealand?
Oh, yeah. Yes, well, certainly the race war, because Australia features very prominently in the book Race War. That is to say, as an outpost of white supremacy in the Pacific, Australia was key to the plans of the British Empire, and also key to Japan's propaganda to portray itself as being the so-called champion of the colored races. As I've mentioned on these airways before, the Australians hesitated to accept Negro troops from the United States, even though they were on the verge of being overrun by Japanese troops about 65-odd years ago. So certainly in the libraries here, a race war, I'm rather happy to say, is very prominently displayed. And I would also say with regard to the book on Zimbabwe as well, because I must say, as a researcher, the National Library of Australia is quite a remarkable library. I mean, it is a very impressive library in terms of the books and manuscript collections in particular, and has one of the largest collections of books in the English language on the history of the so-called British Empire. That would include quite a lot of books on Canadian history, too, for those who might want to pursue that subject in the South Pacific.
Okay, I'm speaking to Professor Gerald Horn. I remember, this is going, taking a little step down memory lane, that you've always made a distinction over and over again, the difference between New Zealand and the difference between Australia, the fact that the Maori people resisted so well. But New Zealand had a very progressive position on the they were in solidarity with most of us on the left on that situation, and I think they had they fought against the rugby team in South Africa, if my memory banks go back that far. What do you remember about New Zealand and the
That's absolutely the case, that New Zealand had a very strong and progressive anti-apartheid movement. Before I forget, I should also mention that I was walking around downtown Brisbane, Australia yesterday, and some of your audience might be happy to know that part of the street artists that you see here are a number of steel bands from Trinidad.
Steel bands, okay.
For these brothers, you know, long dreadlocks and with their oil drums, they're out here and they're jamming on a regular basis, filling the streets with their very pleasant sounds.
Are they from Trinidad or from the Eastern Caribbean?
From Trinidad, as far as I can ascertain.
Okay.
But in any case, yes. So but it's interesting now that, to show you how politics works, Australia is now portraying itself as being in the vanguard in the fight against racism. How so, you say? Because there's a controversy now with the cricket team in Zimbabwe, with a number of the Euro-Zimbabweans resigning, supposedly because they're protesting against what they consider to be the so-called, quote, racist, unquote, policies of the Mugabe administration. And so the Australians are having a debate now as to whether they should boycott Zimbabwean cricket because of the alleged racist policies of Mr. Mugabe's administration. And that is occupying a good deal of the airwaves in this part of the world.
Robert Gabriel Mugabe, he is a very, very controversial human being. I guess when it's written in the next century, it's going to be interesting to see how who controls the laptop. I guess that's who's going to win out.
You got that right. But as I said, I think one of the key things about Zimbabwe right now is the solidarity from its neighbors. Sam Nujoma, the leader of Namibia, was in Harare just a few days ago and issued a statement in solidarity with the efforts of Zimbabwe in the question of land, because, of course, Mr. Nujoma is pursuing similar policies in Namibia. And Mr. Mbeki of South Africa, his slogan is that they're moving from the policy of reconciliation to the policy of transformation. And if that is to become more than just words, more than just a slogan, well, obviously there's going to have to be an acceleration of land reform in South Africa as well. And this is going to create more tension with Ottawa, London, and Washington. So this is a question, like reparations, that is not going away anytime soon.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, only that there's an important vote coming up in Israel, with that is to say within the ruling Likud party, on the question of Mr. Sharon's policies with regard to Gaza. There was a remarkable 70,000 strong demonstration of Israelis in Gaza protesting against Mr. Sharon's plans to withdraw the settlements. So there might be a vote today that overturns what was actually not a very progressive move anyway. In other words, for the Likud Central Committee, Mr. Sharon's bestial right-wing policies are not bestial enough. They want them to be even more reactionary. So certainly that's a vote that we're all going to have to keep our eyes on, because what we might find is that there will be a gigantic leap backwards with regard to Israel, beginning over this weekend.
All right. Thank you very much. And we will be back in touch with you.